Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday the 6th of September, and I'll also continue with Dante and the Seven Deadly Sins. This week, the sin of sloth. Sloth means not doing things you know you ought to do. Dante and Virgil have climbed through the first three terraces of purgatory, where the vices of pride, envy, and anger are cleansed. At the end of each terrace, an angel has wiped away one of the P's from Dante's forehead, P for peccato, or sin. As the burden of sin is wiped away, Dante becomes lighter and lighter, and climbing the mountain gets easier and easier. So there they both are now, climbing the stairs up from the terrace of anger, their eyes still watering from the blinding smoke of anger which filled that terrace. It is 6 p.m. purgatory time on Easter Monday 1300. The sun sets and it gets dark, and at that moment the poets stop being able to climb, because that is the rule of the mountain. The core of poetry is to make a little do a lot. It makes one word, one idea, do many jobs at the same time. The genius of Dante is how many jobs he can make a single idea do all at once. What we are seeing here is an example of just that. Artistically, giving an invented world rules makes it more real to us. A world in which anything at all can happen isn't of much interest to anyone beyond the age of 8. The world we live in has rules, things that can happen and things that can't, and a proper invented world ought similarly to have rules of its own to make it real. Different rules from ours, perhaps, but still rules. And the rule of the mountain, which makes climbing impossible after dark, is just the right kind of rule, for various reasons. Spiritually, you can feel the rule is true. We are incarnate creatures, body and soul, so we are dependent on circumstances. There are times when sunshine fills us with energy and the world lies at our feet and we can do whatever we want, and there are times when the sun is not there and in the darkness we can do nothing. Structurally, any long exposition of anything has to have some sort of rhythm, breathing in and out, varying the pace. To go along at the same pace throughout becomes deadly quite quickly. It's like going along a washing line, counting the socks, sock after sock, just as here we have terrace after terrace, and suddenly we can't take it any more. Once we have understood the pattern, to have that same pattern go on and on and on, and on, and on, and on, and on, all of a sudden it is intolerable. Narratively, this particular change of pace is a perfect opportunity to do something rather useful in a big, structured story, to explain what the structure is. You stop letting the story carry you along for a bit, and you stand outside it for a moment to reflect on it as a whole. In our lives, that is one of the things something like Lent is useful for. I know that everyone's advice to a beginning lecturer is always, tell them what you're going to say, say it, tell them what you've said. But if you have ever listened to a lecture like that, starting with, I am now going to tell you 7 things, you know perfectly well that you will not listen to any of those 7 things. You will find yourself doing nothing but counting on your fingers. 1, 2, 3, 4, are we nearly there yet? And longing for something to happen, anything to happen, for the fire alarm to go off. Lists mean death. That's why Dante the poet has waited with his explanations until we've lived through some of the terraces. Now it is a safe time, and the right time, to sit us down and tell us about how it all works. Theologically, the point is this. The first three sins, that is, the lowest three sins, are love perverted, twisted out of its proper shape and made to point the wrong way, making it into a love of harm. In the end, pride wants to cut down every tree in the forest except you. In the end, envy wants there to be no tall trees near you. In the end, anger, which started as a vigorous love of putting things right, isn't happy unless someone gets hurt in the process. All these deadly sins end up as a love of harm. That is one kind of way of stopping you from living real love. But there is another way of not loving, and that is simply not to love. And that is the deadly sin of sloth. Sloth is what makes you not do things that you ought to do. Now, nothing is harder to describe than something. So not doing is harder to talk about than doing. This is why different writers talk about not doingness in different ways. Some talk about tristitia, sadness, because sadness or depression does indeed make doing anything at all feel pointless. Some talk about a disillusionment, or the feeling of what can I do about it anyway. Some talk about apathy. Another aspect of Dante's artistry is that he puts the pause, where the poets are doing nothing because they can't do anything, immediately before the terrace where people who didn't do anything but could have done are being purged of that sin. Climbing is impossible at night, but other activity isn't. All through the night, Dante and Virgil hear the slothful running past, purging their sin, the way you might hear traffic through your bedroom window when you've stopped for a night's rest on a long, long road journey. The slothful run and run. They shout encouragement to one another, about Mary not hesitating for a moment but rushing off to visit her cousin Elizabeth, or about Julius Caesar capturing town after town in Spain by arriving before anyone could imagine he'd have time to get there. And in each group, as they rush past, someone cries out the opposite example, the awful warning. The lukewarm children of Israel who crossed the Red Sea with Moses died before they ever reached the Promised Land. What ought I to be doing? Am I doing enough? These are the kinds of questions thinking about the vice of sloth makes us ask. We are called to be lovers. We have to love to live, because eternal life and eternal love are the same thing. We sort of know this, but immediately the transactional mind takes over, the mind of a child at school calculating, how little can I get away with doing? Do what you can is, of course, the first principle. If you are disabled and cannot move without help, you aren't called to carry old people shopping for them. If you have chronic fatigue, so that it's always a toss-up whether you'll be able to eat because you mightn't have recovered from preparing and eating the last meal, you aren't called to pile more fatigue on yourself. That's obvious. And yet, to look at those extreme cases first, there are ways, when you are disabled, to make life more pleasant or less pleasant for your carers. There are ways, even if you are always tired, to do something, even if it is only listening to the troubles of the people you meet and entering into those troubles and giving what advice you can. That is something that many able-bodied people could do easily, but don't bother. In my experience, people whose life is so extremely limited don't need any advice about sloth. Precisely because their abilities are so constrained, they make full use of what they've got. It's the rest of us, the stronger people, who risk sinking into laziness and wasting our gifts. There is a lot of loving to be done, Jesus told us. Clothing the naked, feeding the hungry, sheltering the homeless, looking after the sick, visiting prisoners. In the Gospel, he quite simply marks these as the difference between heaven and hell. The clever people who write the bidding prayers for use in churches have a problem here, but they solve it quite well. They know that while some of us go to church to meet God, at least as many go there to feel good about themselves, and whichever of these two classes we fall into, being told to inconvenience ourselves is not part of the contract. Listen carefully to your bidding prayers next Sunday. We pray sometimes for the sick, sometimes for people who are mentally ill or desperate or suicidal or losing their jobs, all sorts of people in distress, and that in itself is a jolly good thing. But watch the pattern. Unless your church is an unusual one, you will pray, may they be looked after and healed about the sick. About people in other kinds of distress, you will pray, may they receive the help and comfort they need. In every case, there is something in the prayer which isn't read aloud, because everyone knows it's there and most sincerely means it. We ourselves intend to do nothing whatever about these people's troubles, but we do sincerely hope that someone does, the government, or anyway, someone whose job it is, anyone at all, as long as it's not us. I have sometimes toyed with the idea of reading out the whole of what the petition really means, and not just the actual words printed on the paper in front of me. But I love reading in church too much, and I don't want to be kicked out. Thus, we institutionalize sloth. Here are some of the things sloth says to each of us. Other people are doing everything that can be done. Or, nothing needs doing. Or, nothing is worth doing. Or, these people don't need help. Or, these people don't deserve help. All these different excuses are why people who write about sloth give it so many different names. But here's the hope in all this. Wicked people do use these excuses to keep themselves comfortable on their way to hell, but these same damnable excuses is what we say to ourselves, not because we don't care, but because we do. We do care, and we know the need, but we also know how inadequate we are to help. Because we care, that knowledge hurts, so we try to ease the pain by hiding the whole thing away in a corner. Clothe the naked, you might say. There are 100 families in this town where the parents go shivering all winter because they have cut up their coats to make warm clothes for their children. How could I, just one of me, make any difference to such a big problem? Here is a possible way out of what is, spiritually, a very uncomfortable situation. If there are indeed 100 families with parents shivering with cold, make a resolution to ignore completely the plight of 99 of them. That's right, ignore them. Leave them all to the pseudo-support of the bidding prayer, where we all say, may they receive help. But you pick just one family whom you will help. If you leave the 99 and concentrate on just the one, you really are able to do something for them. At least someone in the town will end up with a warm coat rather than cold aspirations. And more may happen because you can never quite trust God to do nothing. As you hear his call in this little way and help one family out of the 100 that need help, someone else may hear his call as well, and someone else. God, who has stirred up your own heart, will stir up others. There may even be enough of them that all parents end up warm this winter. That is indeed something worth praying for, but the prayer works because you yourself are doing your bit, and in the end a bit plus a bit plus a bit will add up to a lot. Look at many of the great works of charity which are huge now, or at many of the lives of the saints we so admire. They, too, started from nothing. Which is a good moment to turn to St. Peter Claver. He is celebrated this week on Wednesday the 9th. He is one of the most important figures in the history of the Americas, and he is worth contemplating because it makes one proud to be a member of the same human race as him. It's only fair to start the story of St. Peter Claver with another saint, St. Alfonso Rodriguez, a very unimportant saint indeed. I say unimportant because in worldly terms he was, but then again so was Mary, and Mary changed the history of the world. Alfonso Rodriguez was born in 1532. He went to school for just a year, because his father died and he had to help his mother look after the family's wool business. By the age of 32 he had been married and widowed, and his 4 children were all dead. He tried to enter the religious life. He was rejected for the priesthood because of his lack of education. He tried to study, but that was a failure. He applied to the Jesuits, but again he was rejected. But the church is blessed now and then by people in authority who recognize holiness and know when to break rules. By order of the Jesuit provincial, Alfonso was admitted as a lay brother. He was sent to the new Jesuit house on the island of Mallorca. Not being much good for anything else, he fulfilled the office of porter at the institution for the next 46 years. I said that as if portering were unimportant, but it isn't. A porter sees people every day and knows them. He watches them. He knows when they are in distress or doubt, and he can comfort them. He knows when they need advice and can give it. And more often than you think, his advice comes from God. So never look down on the porter figures in your own life, but try to listen to them. Now for Peter Clavin. He was the son of a Catalan farmer and was able to follow a Jesuit career in the proper way. By 1605 he was studying philosophy on Mallorca, and it was there that he met Alfonso Rodriguez, who by then was 73 years old. Alfonso told Peter that God was calling him to evangelize the Spanish possessions in America. So Peter did. It isn't recorded whether the simple command was sufficient or whether it took months of persuasion. It is enough to know that Peter obeyed. He arrived at Cartagena in Colombia in 1610. He completed his education and was ordained there in 1616. The history of the Spanish in the Americas is unique because they took into account considerations ignored by most other colonial enterprises. In particular, they thought about what was the right thing to do and how to go about doing it. The fact that human vice and frailty often failed to put those choices into effect is tragic, but even so, some of the right decisions were made, and they did have good and lasting consequences. From the very start of the conquista, there were religious people concerned for the well-being of the American Indians. At one point, further westward voyages from Spain were even halted until a clear decision could be reached. There was a famous debate in the university city of Valladolid in 1550, in which the question, if you oversimplify, was, were the Indians human? From there, relentless Spanish logic took over. If they were human, then they were Spanish, because they lived in territories conquered by Spain. If they were Spanish, then they were Spanish citizens, and they had the rights of Spanish citizens, not least the right not to be expropriated and not to be enslaved. Good decisions are one thing, the Atlantic Ocean is something else. 1,000 obstacles stood in the way of a decision made in the centre taking effect in the New World. One governor of Peru who tried to defend the status of the Indians was even murdered by his fellow colonists, but some effect it did have. The Mexican writer Octavio Paz likes to compare the state of the Spanish Empire, where Indians officially existed and where in Latin American countries they continue to exist in their many millions, with that of the English-speaking colonies further north, where, politically, Indians did not exist at all, and now mostly don't exist. But good decisions sometimes have unexpected consequences. Labour was needed for the gold mines, for the sugar plantations, and elsewhere. Spaniards did not want to do it. Indians, as Spanish citizens, could not be forced to do it. Fortunately, you might say, there was an abundant human resource readily available close at hand. In a society without guns and industrial-scale means of coercion, defeated enemies have always represented a problem. They are dangerous. You either have to massacre them or enslave them. The ancient Greeks used to do both. The kings of West Africa, in their constant wars, had a continuous supply of defeated enemies and could only accommodate a certain number of them as slaves. Transferring human resources from a location of surplus to a location of shortage removed the need for massacres. It was an obvious and humane solution. We know the kinds of consequences that ensued. They were terrible and tragic, and the more tragic in that some good people really did think that they were doing the best thing. A few of them lived long enough to be able to see the true face of what they had started. At exactly the same time that Peter Clavin arrived in Colombia, down south in Paraguay, the Jesuits had started to construct the reductions, small autonomous Indian communities which could grow and confront the colonists on equal terms. This was the kind of grand politics the Jesuits could excel at, and heartbreakingly frustrating though the work sometimes was, there was real hope of its success. Until, over a century later, bigger geopolitical forces swept it all away. Meanwhile, back up in Cartagena, Peter Claver had no grand aim. People call him the apostle to the Negro slaves now, but he set himself up to be simply the slave of the Negroes forever. He laboured on their behalf for 33 years, attending to both their spiritual and material needs. The slave trade was repeatedly condemned by the popes, but it was too profitable to be stopped, and on the whole the local church hierarchy kept quiet about it, much as they were to do in North America in the 19th century. Peter brought fresh food to the slave ships as they arrived. He instructed the slaves and baptized them in the faith. He followed their progress and kept track of them even when they were sent to the mines and plantations, defending them as well as he could from oppressive slave owners. He organized teams of catechists who spoke the many languages spoken by the slaves. He worked in hospitals also, looking after lepers among others, and in prisons. If you possibly can, do look at the spiritual reading page for Wednesday in the Universalis app this week and read one of his letters about the arrival of a slave ship. Naturally, he made himself unpopular by his work. As his superior said, unfortunately for himself, he is a Catalan, pig-headed and difficult. Opposition came from both within the church and outside it, but there were exceptions, as there always are in these cases. On the one hand, many fashionable ladies refused to enter his city churches because they had been profaned by the presence of the blacks. But on the other hand, a few, such as Doña Isabel de Urbina, became his strong and lifelong supporters. There is a distant echo here of St. Mary Magdalene, one of the group of women of substance who accompanied Jesus and his disciples and made sure that everyone was fed and provided for. Now the thing is, if you are faced with an evil as big as New World slavery, you have many good arguments for not dashing off to the New World at once. The problem is so big and there is only one of you. Faced with such hugeness, you will think of doing huge things at home, at the centre, where the power is. Campaigns, publicity, meetings with important influential people in well-appointed drawing rooms, raising awareness, we'd say nowadays, all manner of theoretically good stuff. But somehow, St. Peter Claver, who had no grand plans beyond going to where the trouble was and doing directly whatever he could, makes those drawing rooms look rather dowdy. On one side are the comfortable armchairs of the people with power and position. On the other side are seas of liquid mud, with here and there a mound of broken bricks for the sick to lie on. And however inadequate it makes us feel, and however useless we would probably be in those circumstances, somehow we know which side is the right side to be on. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.